Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. My name's Clayton Boyce, and I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor of the Knight Ridder Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On Wednesday, Carol Browner, Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, will discuss environmental protection and children's health. On Thursday, July 1st, Attorney General Janet Reno will discuss her agenda for criminal justice reform. On Friday, July 2nd, South African President F.W. de Klerk will present a speech entitled South Africa on the Threshold of Democracy. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include the President of the United Mine Workers Union, Rich Trumka, Postmaster General Marvin Runyon, Secretary of Health and Human Services Donna Shalala, Secretary of Transportation Federico Pena, and the Director of the National Hurricane Center, Dr. Robert Sheets. Audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. Robert Strauss, so many great lines, so many of them unfit for a live radio broadcast. Washington man about the globe and Texan extraordinaire, today's salty tongue speaker has a resume for the record books. He was this country's last ambassador to the Soviet Union and its first to the newly reconstituted Republic of Russia. He has been chairman of the National Democratic Party, a Middle East negotiator, international trade ambassador, and at the very outset of his career, a special agent for the FBI. He was also Jimmy Carter's anti-inflation advisor and the chairman of Carter's 1980 reelection campaign. Oh, well, you can't win them all. In most respects, though, his is a classic American success story. Robert Strauss has come a long way from the counter of his parents' dry goods stores in Stamford, Texas, where he grew up the only Jewish boy in town by his own typically exaggerated account. He did, after all, have a brother. As a protege of the late John Connolly, a University of Texas Law School classmate, Mr. Strauss learned the ropes in the rough and tumble world of Texas politics, but his talents soon were recognized nationally. As National Democratic Treasurer in the 1970s, he helped rescue the party from a sea of red ink. Later, he was tapped as chairman to put the pieces back together after George McGovern's devastating 1972 defeat. Today, he sits atop Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld, a friendly neighborhood law firm of 480 lawyers in Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, Houston, Washington, New York, and Brussels. Mr. Strauss is widely regarded as one of the most powerful and successful lawyer lobbyists in town. Just how successful was revealed in a financial disclosure statement when he became ambassador. It showed that during the previous 18 months, Strauss had raked in $6.5 million. He's a great role model for the newly capitalist Russia, I think. If party affiliation could be worn like a suit of clothes, Robert Strauss would be Washington's premier political crossdresser.
I repeat that.
Well, he did get his start working for J. Edgar Hoover, of course. I'm afraid to look. Is he still sitting there? Mr. Strauss spent the 1980s working to elect Democrats to the White House and then cheerfully accepted the hospitality of the Republicans, who got there instead. Mr. Strauss is everywhere. In 1990, he was on both sides of the $8 billion Matsushita MCA buyout, During the fight over funding for Nicaraguan Contras, he was friends with both the pros and the antis and managed to get both sides talking. Even more incredible, Mr. Strauss is able to do the same with both sides of the Democratic Party. Is that all there is? Two sides? I'm not sure. Mr. Strauss makes no apologies for his political promiscuity. Speaking of his bipartisan aide and counsel to the White House, Mr. Strauss once told an interviewer that advising presidents pleases my vanity. I like it. What he did not especially like, though it may have pleased his vanity, was his stint as ambassador to Russia. He was uncomfortable in the official residence there. Only six more showers to go, he told reporters, as he was counting the days till his homecoming. Besides, there aren't any good racetracks in Moscow. He does seem to have left a mark, though. Rick Dunham, one of our head table guests today, recently returned from travels to the former Soviet Union, reports seeing Lone Star beer on sale at the food kiosks, as well as a brand of cigarettes called Texas. We're dubious about Mr. Strauss's hand in the tobacco sales, though. Surely no Texan worth his salt would sell them for 20 cents a pack, which is the going price there. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the National Press Club and the environs of Pimlico and Laurel Racetracks, America's Mr. Everything, Robert Strauss.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I believe that was one of the most gracious, inaccurate, smart-ass introductions I've had in a long time. Furthermore, it wasn't an $8 million buyout. That was my fee. And finally, I must say that the reason I missed part of some of his lines was that this introducer is not all he's cracked up to be. He asked me if I wanted his $100 introduction or his $200 introduction, and I, being a cheapskate, slipped him $100. During the introduction, I was wondering what the hell I would have gotten if I'd have paid the $200. More seriously, I thank you, and I know I don't need to tell most of you out there how pleased I am to be here. I have many friends in the audience who have been here on many press club occasions, and you enumerated a long history of Bob Strauss in Washington, and I have been in every role, temporary or otherwise. I have appeared before this press club and always been graciously and warmly received, and I have a special affection for this institution, and I have always felt that I had almost some sort of unusual, unique relationship, incestuous almost, with the press of this town, and I have no apologies for it. I enjoy it very much. They've been our friends, and I have tried to be theirs. And the fact I have been here, the last time I was here was when I came home to give my only public appearance that I recall of any consequence during my tenure as ambassador. And I came to the press club to report to America on what had taken place. And so it is, I come back today. This is the last appearance I'm going to make, I hope, for a while. I spent the last few months, I promised Boris Yeltsin when I left Moscow that I would tell the story of what was taking place in Russia around our country, and that I thought I could do more for, as much or more for Russia in this country as I could in that country. And I have been traveling the country and speaking, and this is the last formal engagement I have. You're very fortunate that I have no prepared remarks today. I have given several commencement speeches, and they've all been fully prepared, and never did anyone deliver more boring remarks to more nice young people than I have done the last couple of months. And I do a little better, or hopefully a good deal better, just sort of talking with friends, and so it is that I will do it today. And what I'd really like to do is not make a speech, but I would like to sort of informally, if I can, see if I can put things in a little bit better perspective than I think most people in our country have the Russian situation. There is simply tremendous interest on the part of the American public in what's going on there. Tremendous interest, far more than anyone, I think, realizes, and far more than I realize, and requests for speaking engagements stack up like that from all different kinds of groups who want to hear what's going on, what's taking place in Russia today. And one thing that's taking place, I think, is that we tend to lose our perspective. And I would remind you that those who wonder why more hasn't taken place, why more progress hasn't been made, those who are already beginning to tire of the effort and what they think is the expense of this country's engagement in that part of the world, forget that Boris Yeltsin hasn't been in office 2 years yet. Communism fell less than 2 years ago. And when you stop and think of the progress that's been made and what's going on over there, the companies that are opening up and doing business, that they're in the process of writing a new constitution, a constitution it looks very much like our own, with three separate bodies of government, three separate branches of government, that talks about human rights and civil rights. When you stop and think that that's taking place right now out in the open, and less than 2 years ago, the Communist Party was running Russia. And I think we have to keep that in perspective, to have any appreciation of what's taking place and of what we should be doing. I must say to you that for a fellow in his 70s to have the opportunity, I say to people informally, we arrived in Moscow, and I arrived to take a front row seat on the greatest revolution in the history of the world. And after 4, 5, 6, 7 months of developing a few relationships, moved from the front row to backstage, if you will, and to see all that take place, no one could be blessed with a more rewarding and exciting experience. And I have said that seeing firsthand the collapse of communism and seeing the development of democracy, seeing democracy spring out of communism into being, if it's not as powerful as the earth moving closer to the sun, it's certainly the human equivalent of that. It is simply indescribable. And to see people whose history was a void, a history of, that they looked back and saw a history of lies and of ignorance and of brutality, a history of no civil rights and no human rights and no dignity, a history of darkness and fear, and at most half-truths, at best half-truths, people who woke one morning to see everything that they had believed for their lives and the lives of their parents before them, seeing all of this discredited by everything they saw around them, not discredited by stories or rumors, but discredited by their life, by the facts, by the fact that for the first time a window opened and they could see the see democracy, see a world they never really knew existed, a world of freedom and democracy and of beauty and of culture and of all these, and of freedom, and know that they had never been a part of that, and their parents hadn't, and their children probably would not, much less themselves. And for these people to hear the world then say, these people who have the courage to go through this and to come out of this, and then I wonder what they think when they read that many in the West, many of the civilized countries of the world say, well, we need to help them a little bit, but they've got to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. Any damn fool knows that you can't take a society like that, that has seen nothing that we take for granted in the West. They just can't pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. It's going to take help. Now, it isn't, when I say help, people start saying, oh, foreign aid, giveaways. This has nothing to do with foreign aid. It has nothing to do with giveaway. This has something to do with self-interest, and this has something to do with investment in our own future and investment in the peace of the world. And while I know that history will justifiably strongly applaud the 40 years effort that the West made, led by the United States, to cause the or help bring about the collapse of communism as we resisted it strongly. And I think that we are entitled to great credit for that. And I think that we are entitled to take credit for the management of the collapse of communism as it took place. And I think it was managed well, and I think this country played a significant and important role in it, and we have a right to be proud of that. But I don't think that we in the West, I think history will not be very kind to us. I think they will not be very kind to us when they realize and review our inability. And when I say our inability, I would personally take my share of the blame for that. It wouldn't be my role, and it was nowhere near as large as many others, but I had a little role. But we failed to grasp really what was taking place, and to grasp, as we should, the opportunity to move in and strongly help motivate and help bolster and help move forward those processes that were taking place. And I think history will give us, at best, a C-minus grade on that. And I think that's what we have to catch up on now. And as I say, it is more than just money. It's the engagement of people, it's engagement of ideas, it's engagement of technical assistance. It's that, and as well as government-to-government help, but it's primarily individual-to-individual and private sector-to-private sector help that's going to have to pull us out of that. But it is going to take government-to-government help, and it's going to take these international institutions that are there to provide that help, understanding that this is a unique situation. This does not fit the rules of the game that we've all played by in so long. But democracy is going forward out there, and we can't in our country, we can't transport or transplant democracy from here to Russia. Russia is going to have to develop its own democracy in its own way, with its own Russian flavor. And they're trying their best to, and will, in my judgment. I think the genie of freedom is out of the bottle, never to be put back in. I think it's out of the bottle, never to be put back in. I'm not concerned about a return to communism. I must say that I am concerned that the West permit a void to exist there, a void to exist that frustrated naval demagogues to capture the imagination of frustrated people, hungry and frustrated, and people who feel they've been abandoned, for a demagogue to move in into that void is a real possibility. Well, I think that that President Clinton, who has had his shares of ups and downs, and but I think he deserves credit for the way he grasped the Russian situation and the situation in that part of the world. I think he, I think President Yeltsin is grateful to President Clinton for taking the lead as he did and being outspoken instead of being timid. And I think I hope that we will be able to make something out of that. I would remind you that on both occasions that the turning back, turning away from freedom has been a possibility, the turning away from democracy has been a possibility, and in both instances, it wasn't outsiders, it was the Russian people themselves who stepped in and said no. First was when, about the time I arrived, in the middle of the coup when I arrived, August 1991, when the people rose up and refused and joined in with behind Yeltsin, then President of Russia, to see that President Gorbachev, head of the Russian Federation, was returned to power, even though temporarily. But the Russian people who rose up and did that, and the Russian people who declined to get involved on the other side. And the other time was in this recent referendum, when the Russian people voted affirmatively, one, for Boris Yeltsin, and two, to my shock and surprise, and I suspect to a bit of surprise on the part of President Yeltsin, that they voted yes, they supported his programs. Now, it's hard for me in this country, as a fellow who's been in politics a long time, to imagine a leader going before his constituents at a time that his constituents are having the trouble that the general body politic, the general public is having in Russia, and asking, do you support my programs? And he voted yes on that. And I think that's the most heartwarming thing that's happened over there, a public thing. And so on both of those occasions, it wasn't the government and it wasn't foreign governments, it was the people who have stepped in two dangerous situations. What's going on now? Let me just quickly conclude by saying there, as most of you know, they're in the middle of, as I mentioned earlier, rewriting a constitution. It will be the drafts that I have seen of pieces of it are good. It provides, as I said, for an executive, a legislative, and a judicial branches. It provides for human rights and for civil rights, and it has a bicameral legislative content in it. And I think my judgment is when they come back in the next couple of days, this group to write this draft constitution, I think they will agree on one. I hope they will, and I believe they will. I hope they can do it in reasonably short order. And then we'll come, they may not be able to. There are problems over just this very day on head of the Supreme Soviet, Hasbulatov, who is an opponent of President Yeltsin, trying to pull his people out of this constitutional convention, as I would call it and we would call it. But I think that we'll go forward. Then will come the question, well, what do you do with the damn thing when you have it? How do you adopt it? There is no process. There's a possibility that they could get enough votes in the parliament, although it's going to be very tough to do, because you remember the parliament has about 65-70% of the old apparatchik still in control of the parliament, as well as its chairman. They may go to another public referendum. I don't know how he will effectively adopt it. But I'll tell you something that's fascinating, was fascinating to me. If you go back and think of this country not too much over 200 years ago, you could almost change the names in the same debates going on, trying to figure out what kind of constitution they wanted, what kind of powers they would have, how much or how little the president would have, what kind of check and balances would take place. The same arguments that we were having, the same debates, how are we going to get the darn thing approved, what will we call the leader? There was no one knew we were going to have a president. We had a guy who would have made a classy man on a white horse, a dictator in George Washington. Everyone would have been glad to follow him anywhere. They stumbled across the idea of a president and didn't really know what his duties and responsibilities were going to be. So history, in many respects, is replaying itself now. there. Power is flowing more and more to the regions there, which is good. On a macro basis, there's nothing good going on economically. I've talked about political things. Politically, things are moving forward in the economic area. On a macro basis, it's just terrible. There is nothing good going on. But when you get below the macro and look at the micro on a micro level, there's a little business opening here and a little company going private there and another one going private here and investors coming in and investing American dollars and English pounds and as well as Russian money, the Russian ruble. And as more and more this economy is being privatized and to show you what's happened over there, when I arrived in Moscow in August 91, the ruble was 37 rubles to the dollar. Today it is 1,100 rubles to the dollar. Now when you stop and think what that does to old people on pensions, now their pensions have been increased somewhat, but and working people on fixed salaries, and those salaries have gone up, but nothing to offset that kind of inflation. I heard an amazing figure the other day. I don't know that it's true, but a very, very competent observer, a fellow that I have as much confidence in as I do anyone observing Russia today, he said to me, you know, the dollar is becoming even more than when you left, Mr. Ambassador, is the standard of value there. More and more dollars. And I said, I wonder how many damn dollars, U.S. dollars, are floating around in Russia today. And he said to me, our estimate is that a minimum of $20 billion and a maximum of $30 billion. Now that is a lot of American dollars. I wonder how they got there. I wonder how many of them have gone offshore, how many of them are hidden someplace and are not floating around. But that's what's happened to that economy over there. Well, people ask me, and I'll quickly conclude, they say, will Russia make it? Will Yeltsin make it? And I think to answer that question, you almost have to define what making it means. In my terms, if you want to know what I think, by making it, I mean democracy will survive. That's one thing. I believe that will take place. Number two, if making it economically is a part of the equation, and it is, I think they will make it in the economic arena, but again, putting it in proper perspective. I think it's entirely possible that within, by the year 2000, 7 years from now, 8 years from now, 9, 10 years from now, 2005, within a 10-year framework, if the West stays engaged and we don't tire too much and we furnish the kind of technical and other help they need, I think that there's every reason to believe that Russia could look much like we looked in this country, shortly after World War I, that kind of economy. It would look sort of like St. Louis or Abilene or Fort Worth or Washington or Chicago looked well before World War II and not too long after World War I. That kind of economy, I don't know how to describe it any better than that. I've described it that way for myself several times, and I'm reasonably comfortable with it. And that's where in those terms, my answer is yes, Russia will make it, and Boris Yeltsin, who must of necessity be a transitional figure, as Gorbachev was, in a world's greatest revolution, leaders are transitional figures. But Gorbachev played his role, and he moved off the stage, not gracefully, but he moved off the stage. And I think that Boris Yeltsin has a continuing role to play, and he's a good politician and a good leader, and he is as viciously anti-communist as any man can be, and as strongly pro-American as you could expect any ex-communist and any Russian to be. And I think that he will survive and contribute for a substantial period of time. And I would, again, to put it in perspective, say to you that the day I arrived in Moscow, I was driven in with bodyguards and security and three-car security, and tanks and barricades were up around the embassy and in the streets, and it was a frightening time of turmoil. And when I left, a young man named John Steffens, who's here with us as my guest here today, drove me, and we quietly drove through serene streets, much quieter than the streets of Washington. There was no security. There was Helen and John and me. And we had a pleasant drive, and it was a lovely day, and the streets looked like they would look here, so or better. And so it is that I say that if we stay engaged, if we stay hitched, I think Russia will make it, and we in America will be better for it. But we have to keep the American people understanding. I have a quote I wrote down that I've used several times, of Justice Learned Hand, that I think expresses what I think America's interests are far better than I could. He wrote many years ago, justice is not a domestic institution. Even in our own interest, we must have an eye to the interests of others. For a nation which lives only to itself will in the end perish. False to the faith, it will shrivel and pass to that oblivion that is its proper receptacle. Thank you very much.